I think we potentially over the next 5, 10, 15 years are going to really start to be able to prevent arthritis and potentially cut down knee and hip replacements, but we're not there yet. I think we're getting there. It's just really tricky.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who loves to play Just Dance when her husband Steve is away, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Thank you so much for joining me for the Running for Real podcast, episode number 15. Can't believe that I'm already at 15, although in some ways it feels like I've been doing this for such a long time, probably because I did have a previous podcast before this. But anyway, so last week I spoke to Magda Boulay, who kind of shared her journey from being an Olympian in the marathon to winning Western States and finishing this year in that brutal one that we heard a lot about. Now, she was so sweet and just had so much great advice for us all. If you did miss that one, you definitely want to make sure you go back and check it out, because she is just such a sweetheart. And I think everyone is going to appreciate her advice, especially as she is so experienced in so many different things. And it's just a wonderful episode to make sure you go listen to. So this week we are talking to Dr. David Geyer. Dr. David and I had a great chat about all kinds of running injuries, including compartment syndrome, which no one really talks about. It's something my husband went through, and it's pretty unknown in the running world, although it does happen quite often. So I wanted to ask him about that, but we don't talk about that till the end. We do talk about some other interesting things about why runners get injured so easily. We talk about Joan Benoit and her incredible journey in the 17 days before the Olympic trials, where she had surgery on her knee and then ended up finishing first in the trials. So it's just an amazing story. And also, Dr. David and I talked about something that I have always kind of wondered about, but I finally had someone I could ask, which is about children or kids when they are running and training. Like, just how much damage are children actually doing to their bodies if they do train too early? And it's really, really interesting, this discussion about this. If you do have children, or you're even thinking about having children in the future, this is definitely something you want to listen to. I want to take this moment just to thank you so much for all your support you have given me of the Running for Real podcast. And anytime you go check out either of my sponsors, Generation UCAN or Get The, anytime you check out their website or purchase their products, that sends a direct link to them saying, thank you so much. Continue to support Tina. So the more you support them, the more you support me. So thank you so much for that. All right, let's get on with the interview. Smoothies, recovery bowl, bars, cookies, biscotti. What do all of those have in common? Any ideas? You can make them with Generation UCAN. How's that for a win-win? Learn more about Generation UCAN at generationucan.com, and I will give you a coupon code later in the episode for 10% off. David, welcome to the Running for Real podcast. I am really excited to dive into some of these topics today, and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited too.
This is going to be fun. And I have to ask you before I forget, because my podcast editor keeps reminding me, I keep forgetting to ask, do you have a fun fact or a hidden talent that you would like to share with us? Something that people don't know that maybe will kind of be a bit surprising to them?
I don't know that I necessarily have any special talents. I think the one that my patients are always surprised about is that I tell you, I enjoy doing this kind of thing, you know, podcasting and writing articles and newspaper columns. And you know, I wrote a book probably more than I even enjoy seeing patients in clinic and getting athletes back, which is great too. But I think the being able to talk about this type of thing and help people overcome and prevent these injuries that, you know, people that aren't my patients is probably something that I never in a million years would have expected.
Yeah, definitely. You should create some kind of app or something where someone can like point to a digital like pain and then you can be like, oh, that's this. Like maybe yeah, sometime in the future, that'll be you.
Yeah, I can't say I'm much of a tech guy is the problem, which is not good when you're trying to do a podcast and a blog and all that. Tech skills are not my thing, but no, I think you're probably right. Helping people in sort of almost like a menu type of format probably would be interesting.
I'm sure a lot of the listeners are nodding along thinking that that's something they'd be interested in. So then let's kind of talk a bit about who you are and what you do. So you're an orthopedic surgeon, sports medicine specialist. So tell us about, like, what does a typical day involve for you?
Yeah, basically we have sort of three main roles in orthopedic surgery in sports medicine. We obviously operate people that have injuries that need surgery. There's the clinic side where we're evaluating people sometimes for the first time, sometimes it's in a follow-up type of thing, and treating people in ways that don't need surgery. So surgery clinic. And then the third side of it is sort of the event coverage or game coverage. So, being on the sidelines for a football game or in the medical tent for a marathon, that type of thing. So those are sort of our three roles. My enjoyment, I love the surgery, but the best part of it for me is the clinic, where the excitement that you see on somebody's face when you tell them they can go back and run or they can go back and lift weights. You know, they get back to what they love to do. There's nothing better than that excitement. When they've been out of something for 6 weeks or 6 months, it's really great.
Which I love that you said that, because I do feel like I have met some people over the years who have seen it as like, will you stop asking already? You know, it becomes a bit of an inconvenience. And you know this, that runners are very like type A and we like to be in control and we like to, you know, tell me exactly when I'm going to be healed to the day. And it's nice to hear someone who's like excited about that moment. So that's really good to hear. And something I wanted to ask you about to start off with is, I know we are all very guilty of, when we have like a pain, thinking, I know who I'm going to go talk to about my injury, going to the computer, opening it up and typing to Dr. Google and saying, what is wrong with me? So maybe you could explain, like, what are the dangers of that? Like, why should we not do that? Because I'm constantly telling people who are in my community, like, don't post your injuries and say, what should I do? Because you can't self-diagnose for the most part. So maybe you could kind of tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, and I think there's good and bad when it comes to looking for information online. I'm a big fan generally of anyone trying to get as much information about whatever they're dealing with as they can. I get hundreds of questions from people every week. Half of them have seen a doctor already, and they still don't know what their injury means or what they should do about it. So there's a communication problem there. And I think then those people turn to the internet. But you're right. I think a lot of people do it on the front end. And the challenge on the internet is you don't really know the quality of the information, and you go to all these different sites and you get in different levels and different depth of information, and it's not consistent. So it's really tricky. I think it's a good place to start with the knowledge that that can't be all you do. Mm-hmm. And I think it gets to sort of this bigger picture, and runners are the best at this, best example of this, that they'll just keep going and just sort of ignore pain or say, hey, I don't really want to go see a doctor. But so many running injuries are things that if you deal with them early, it's not going to be surgical. Very likely it's not going to be surgical, and very likely it's not going to be a long period out of running. But if you find out what it is, take some simple steps to get over it, it's going to be a lot better at that point than if you wait 6 months and now you've got a problem that either needs surgery or it needs months out of running. Mm-hmm. And so I think the internet should be sort of a nudge to maybe push you in the direction of getting it checked out. But I think the bigger issue is, if you're hurting and you can't run as well as you want, maybe you go see somebody.
So would you say, if you are taking the time to Google something, that that's the reminder that, hey, this is obviously bothering you enough that you've taken the time to look it up, so maybe it's time to consider what you're doing here?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way to put it. I haven't thought of it that way. But, you know, I mean, I think generally if you... You know, if you're just like, hey, you know, looking for, hey, I'll try some simple, I'm looking, you know, would taping help for a particular problem, or would a different type of insert in my shoe help this pain I'm having? And you decide, all right, I'm going to try that, and it does help, then hey, I'm fine with it. But if, yeah, very quickly, you're not making much progress, I think just making sure you don't have something else is never a bad thing.
Okay. And then if someone is saying, all right, I need to go see someone, I agree, it's time to get it checked out. Do you have any advice for people who have traits, maybe what to look for someone to know what in their area what to look for? Because obviously you're passionate about it. I mean, I know of sporadic people around the world who are passionate about it, but we don't all live in those locations. So any particular traits you would mention?
That's a great point. And not every physician or even other types of medical professionals are going to be as interested in getting you back to what you love to do, I think. And runners, I hear this a lot for whatever reason. You know, they feel like their doctors really have a thing against runners and just say, hey, you have to stop running. And I'm sure you're this way and I'm this way. And most people listening, that's not what they want to hear, that they can't run anymore. So I think my advice would be a couple of things. One, if you're going to a doctor, look for somebody that does sports medicine. And in the United States, it's called sports medicine. It's different things in other areas, but people that really work with athletes and active people. So that would be one route. The other route that I think is good, that I think is overlooked in the United States, at least, and maybe in other parts of the world, are the role of physical therapists or physiotherapists. Mm-hmm. We think of them as rehabbing injuries, but a lot of them can evaluate injuries before you go to the doctor, show you some exercises to do that may help you get better, show you maybe some taping or some stretching or modifications of your stride, whatever it is. And they can get it better pretty quickly too. So I think they play a large role in evaluating these injuries.
Okay, that's helpful. And then what about when it comes to, you know, related to the Google issue, when you see a new article come out that completely contradicts everything you know, and then 6 months later, something else, it contradicts it again. How do we know what research to trust with this stuff coming out?
It's really tricky. And I see that with running with the shoes. They'll say, hey, we got to go to this type of shoe, or we got to go to barefoot running. And then we got to go to these big, thick rocker sole shoes. And it changes all the time. I don't get terribly worked up generally about any one article. I don't really know that I would change a training strategy or, you know, a treatment or whatever it is based on any one thing. I think if you consistently start seeing research in a certain area or articles being read that consistently say the same things, you have different experts agreeing with it over a period of time, then I think maybe you go for it. I think that the nature of like you say, Google and just everybody has a blog, and you're going to find some random person saying every possible thing, and it's mm-hmm. not always necessarily validated or worthwhile. So I think it's when there starts to be some sort of scientific consensus. And I know the average runner, they're not studying the research, but when you start seeing it in the big running magazines and the health magazines, at that point, it's probably then worth considering.
Okay. Okay. That is helpful. Now, something I wanted to talk to you about, which I think you brought up in your original contact to me, was about Joan Benoit Samuelson. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could tell us a bit about what she did and how that was even possible, because I'm sure most people listening know of what she did. Was it the Olympic trials? I think it was.
Yes.
Maybe you could tell us like how that was even possible, you know, what happened and how she did it.
Yeah, fascinating story. And you know, I don't even really, I vaguely remember it when I was a kid hearing about, I remember her really well, but I don't remember this story very well. But I had the privilege of talking to her coach, Bob Seveny, and he even cried about it on the phone as we were talking about it. It was fascinating. Joan Benoit was the best female runner in the world. 1984 was going to be the first women's Olympic marathon. And she was the world record holder, had blown away the world record the year before in Boston by many, many minutes, was easily going to be even though there were really good runners at the time, was easily going to win the marathon. But a few months before the trials, started to develop this just nagging knee pain. And probably because she was training too hard, running ridiculously fast mile splits and things like that. And, you know, tried what we do today. You try mm-hmm. anti-inflammatories. I think she had a couple cortisone shots. Nothing was getting her better. I mean, they tried all sorts of different things. So the surgeon, she was she was sponsored by Nike at the time. And Nike had a surgeon that was one of their consultants, Stan James, out in Oregon. And he said, look, you know, we've tried everything else. You know, it's basically you can't run anymore or not run anymore, but you're not going to make the Olympics. Or we can try this thing that we don't do that often. It's pretty new, but we can go in and scope your knee and figure out what's wrong. Basically operate where we make a couple little poke holes and look in with a scope. We didn't have MRIs at the time, so that was, they didn't know what was going on. So she was like, look, I can't run. She tried like a 5-mile training run the night before what ended up being her surgery, and she didn't even make it 5 miles. So she ended up having surgery 17 days before the Olympic trials, you know, basically had a knee surgery and got back and didn't just compete in the trials. They actually offered her a spot on the Olympic team, basically, you know, just sort of a, you know, hey, you're good enough. We'll put you on the team. Just go ahead and get healthy. And she wouldn't take it. She's like, if I don't finish in the top three, I don't want to be in it. So she ran it 17 days after knee surgery and won the Olympic marathon trials, which put the arthroscopic surgery on the map because nobody had really heard of it. And then she made it famous to everybody in America. But if we did that today, and we do millions and millions of arthroscopic surgeries now, but if somebody were to run 17 days after a knee surgery now, that would still be unbelievable to win a marathon. So the fact that she did it in 1984, when this was just getting started, to me is just unbelievable.
So how was that possible? For anyone listening, are they thinking, you know, oh, is it just because she's an elite runner? Is it just because she is literally one of the best? Or is it that the like rehab she did afterwards was enough to kind of get her body functioning again, and then the fitness was just carry over from before?
If you ask her coach, he'll say it was largely something that Joan Benoit had, sort of a, he didn't use the term killer instinct, but she had a drive that he's never seen before. And I think that was a lot of it. I have no doubt she was hurting. And I talk about that in the chapter in my book about it. Even during the marathon trial, she was struggling, but she sort of toughed it out. But she pushed herself really hard, just like she was doing before she got head surgery. In fact, her first training run, they ran, and I don't remember off the top of my head, I want to say it was 3 days after her surgery, she ran 9 miles, and Bob 70's like, doctor's going to kill us. And yet she was determined. So I think there was a lot of, I'm going to push myself harder. I need to know if I'm ready. And I think that's what made her an amazing runner, an amazing champion. It also helped her get back from surgery.
And I think actually pool running was a huge part of that rehab in that 17 days. Just for anyone who is injured right now and kind of, you know, a bit fed up and not sure what to do, pool running, I believe from what I read, was a huge part of her maintaining her fitness during, you know, that initial time after the surgery. So speaking of Joan Benoit, because I have seen her run a few times in the last few years and definitely running with a bit of a limp and just doesn't look very like she's enjoying running too much. But it just made me think about like older injuries. So if you've had an injury that you've been dealing with for a long time, you've been ignoring it, it's become chronic. Is it possible to reverse those injuries? I mean, maybe not to Joan's extreme, but if someone is listening and they've got a chronic injury that they have been ignoring, is it possible to kind of reverse the damage?
We're working on it. I want to be optimistic to a certain extent, but it's not perfect. Up to really now in orthopedics, we've been able to sort of repair injuries and get them at least as strong as they were, but not make them the way they were before they got hurt. And I know that's sort of semantics, but we can sew something back together, or we can make a new ligament or something like that. Or in the case of cartilage, a big problem with runners, cartilage in the knee or the hip that breaks down and becomes arthritis, we can smooth it out, things like that. But we've really never had the ability to make structures new like they were when you were 12 or when you were 14. And that gets to something that's coming. And I bet a number of people listening to this podcast, you may have heard of this, you may be dealing with this. If you got arthritis or you've got a nagging hamstring or quad injury or calf injury, and you go to a doctor and they say, hey, you may want to consider PRP, platelet-rich plasma, or stem cells. That's coming, and it's actually already out there, made popular, like a lot of these things, by professional athletes going to Germany and getting all these fancy treatments. But these are substances that come from our bodies. They're sort of engineered in the lab, and then we use them to try to make structures new again. The trick is that we don't know for a fact yet that they do that, that they work. people seem really happy. I did an interview a few days ago with a radio host for something completely unrelated. And he's like, "Hey, I just wanted to let you know I had stem cell treatment and I feel good as new." So I think it does help for a lot of people, but the science is still behind it. And we're asking people a lot of times to spend hundreds and thousands of dollars on things that we can't tell you that we're going to make your knee normal again. Mm. Now, I do think it's the future. I think that we potentially over the next 5, 10, 15 years are going to really start to be able to prevent arthritis and potentially cut down knee and hip replacements, but we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. So to answer, I know it was a long answer
this
question.
Is interesting.
I think we're getting there. It's just really tricky because a lot of these structures, you know, they don't have a blood supply, they don't have nerve endings. And so we're really struggling to make things new again. We can make them better than they were when they were damaged, but that's really the challenge. And I think there's billions and billions of dollars of research going into this right now, but we still have a little ways to go.
So then with the PRP that you were saying about, I know a few people have mentioned this. If someone does have the opportunity to have that done, that is something that you currently stand behind?
I do. I usually tell people, because I probably do it once or twice a day in a day worth of seeing patients in clinic, you know, but insurance, at least in the United States, doesn't pay for PRP. So you have to pay out of pocket. And our office at least just charges just a very small amount over what we get it for, but, you know, for the syringes and the nursing time and things like that. But I rarely use it as the first thing that I try. I'll try, you know, physical therapy or you know, modifying activities a little bit or a variety of different things. And if then it's not working, maybe we'll try platelet-rich plasma. And I tell people, like, this has good success rates if you talk to people, but the studies are still not definitive showing. I can't definitely tell you mm-hmm. it's going to work. But a lot of these people have tried lots of other things. And so they're happy to try it, because if that either avoids a surgery or gives them a chance at getting back to running, they'll take it. And I've been relatively pleased with it, depending on what the problem is. But I think you, as a doctor, you have to be honest with people and say, this could help, but I can't promise you it'll help.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nope. That's helpful. Thank you for clearing that up. So one thing I wanted to ask you about, which you don't know is coming, but it really caught my eye because it's something I'm really passionate about, is you had on, I think it was a blog post on your website, about you really believe it's important for kids to do multiple sports. Now, do you want to tell us about why that is before I ask you anything else?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, well, first of all, that's one of the things that has changed fundamentally about sports at a youth level since at least when I was a kid. I mean, I played, you know, soccer and basketball and baseball and was on the swim team. And every season it was a different sport. And kids don't do that today. As early as 7 and 8 years old, they're being pressed to play one sport and play it year round. And these kids, they don't have the muscle strength. Their bodies aren't able to withstand that same stress on the same part of the body all year long. And so I think that's why the injuries in youth sports are skyrocketing, and they're largely preventable. They're overuse injuries. And I think that would probably be the biggest way to decrease some of those, is just by introducing, even just for one of the seasons of the year, let them do something else to let that part of the body rest. I think it would dramatically help our kids.
And what age are we talking up to here with that kind of recommendation?
I have a caveat to it, but largely I say when you go through puberty. So for the boys around 14, when they start high school, for the girls, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe you can specialize at age 12. The trick to that is there are a couple of sports that by necessity you have to start earlier because of the shape and size of their bodies and what you have to do in that sport. And those are gymnastics and figure skating. You typically have to specialize younger because of what their bodies need to be able to do. But those are really the only sports that I would say it's even worth considering doing a sport year round. And even then, you can make the case to make sure they at least get rest during the year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if someone listening is, they love running, they're really passionate about running, their other half is good at running, and they have a child and their kid is kind of showing somewhat of a promise, why do you think, or if you think, I'd love to hear your thoughts on, should they train them even as children, or is it just kind of should be, hey, if they want to run, they want to run, but don't make it training, just make it kind of playing.
There's a lot of thoughts, a lot of different ways to go with that. I think the first part is I'm a big believer in letting kids decide what they want to do, you know, expose them to it. And then if they love it, have by all means, let them do it. I have issues in every sport with parents pushing kids too hard because, you know, 70% of kids drop out of sports by age 13 and burnout because of pressure from parents and coaches is the biggest reason for that. So I'd be careful to push too hard. I think if they really love running, then by all means do it. I still would say, hey, you do it maybe 8 or 9 months a year, and then 2 or 3 months, they can run a little bit, but let them do something else. Let them get their cardio through swimming or lifting weights mm-hmm. or playing a sport. The problem with running, for especially for kids, if you do it every day all year long, is all that stress is going to basically the feet, the ankles, the legs, and the knees. It's not getting spread throughout the body. So if you could take 2 or 3 months where you do something that stresses their arms, their shoulders, their elbows, you know, that's where swimming or some lifting weights, and give the ankles and the feet and the legs time to rest, that would go a long way at preventing kids from getting hurt. And it really happens, track and cross country, those, you know, high school runners, they're the most common group generally to get stress fractures. Mm-hmm. And I think exactly what you're talking about is the reason why.
Yeah, no, thank you for saying that. And, you know, when you were talking about that, it reminded me, my husband actually did, for his master's, he did a study on Kentucky and the fact that Kentucky allows middle schoolers to run in the high school meet. And he did this research and he found that very, very few, I think, maybe like, it was really small, like under 10 out of 100 kids who ran in the state meet as a middle schooler ran in the state meet their senior year. It was crazy how low it was. And he's convinced it's because, you know, that whole burnout thing of being pushed too much too early and kind of dropping out. So that's why when I saw you were interested in this, I thought this is something that I definitely wanted to talk about. And, you know, especially if it's something that you care about as well. And you also talked about, you know, the difference between fun and winning. So maybe you could tell us your thoughts on that as well.
Well, I mean, I think exactly what you said sort of goes dovetails right into the winning. I think more at least than when I played sports, and I admit I wasn't a star athlete. I played travel soccer when I finally did pick a sport, but I was never I wasn't being recruited by colleges or and certainly never played in the pros. But it was fun. We enjoyed sports. And I think now there is such a mentality that we've got to be seen by the scouts and we've got to be on the right teams with the right coaches. And yes, it's true in track and cross country. I have several elite track coaches as patients of mine, and they push kids hard and recruit really hard, but they're really pushing kids at a very young age. And even more than injuries, which we've talked about, all that pressure on kids leads to this situation where they'll hide pain from their parents and their coaches because they don't want to let their teammates down and they don't want to let their parents and their coaches down. And that pain starts to build up and they get overuse injuries. That pressure just makes it not fun and they burn out of sports. We just need to, at least until maybe they get to the high school ages, just let them have fun. If, again, you talked about if they really love it, then, you know, obviously their passion will motivate them. But I don't know that kids are really at 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, getting yelled at, pushed really that hard, practicing 5, 6 hours a day, training for hours a day. It's just, I don't know that that is good for the long-term mm-hmm. benefit of the athlete. When those kids, we want them running when they're 30 and 40 and 60. And we don't, if they drop out of sports by the time they're 13, they're probably not going to engage in healthy behaviors and exercise as adults. So we really need to sort of reevaluate what we're asking our kids at a young age.
Mm-hmm. So important. Thank you. I agree with everything you just said. And what about the like actual physical damage of this? Have you seen, have there been any studies on damage like later in life from kids who have kind of been pushed too hard too soon?
It hasn't really gotten the studies of the young kids. Those are really kind of hard to follow for years and mm-hmm. years. It has been done interestingly enough, on college athletes that play college sports, varsity college sports.
Okay.
And they follow them later in life into their 40s and 50s. And then they've taken these same studies, look at the college athletes, and they look at other students at that college, same gender, same age, same body, you know, height, weight, all of that, but didn't play college sports. And what they found is that the quality of life of the college athletes is actually worse later in life than the non-athletes. Mm. And so it gets to a bigger point in getting to where with the kids, I think this is where that's true, is that I think that sports push people to play through pain and play through injuries. And doing that can lead to bigger problems down the road, arthritis, chronic pain, you know, things that ultimately may keep you from running when you're older. So I think that if it's true in the college athletes, I suspect it's true with the kids. We just don't have the data on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will be interesting to see if anyone does somehow follow up in the future with that, because I'm sure it would be very interesting. And thanks for sharing about the college kids. That's definitely worth listening to, and kind of gives you something to think about. And so I wanted to ask about a few injuries, as this is your level of expertise. And one thing that I know you did talk about on your website, and I know you've worked a lot with, is people with compartment syndrome. Now, my husband had compartment syndrome. He has told me many times how miserable it was. But I know a lot of people end up almost backing into finding out they have this injury, but there's a lot of conflicting evidence in what to do about it. So maybe you could talk about what the symptoms are for people to kind of watch out for if they have had continuous calf pain and what they can do about it. Because I know it's very confusing from what I've heard.
Absolutely. And let me start because I suspect that there are runners that don't even know what it is. At least judging from my patients that come to my office, they just know they hurt. So let me talk a little bit about what it is. Mm-hmm. This is a condition generally of the legs. You can see it in other parts of the body, but it's almost always the calves, that while people are running, the muscles in their legs swell. Now, that's true in all of us. Everybody, when we run, our muscles swell a little bit. And our muscles are contained in these compartments within the calf with fascia. It's a connective tissue in the leg. And that fascia only gives a certain amount. It can allow the muscles to expand a little bit, but it can't expand that much. And people, a small subgroup of runners, can have their muscles swell so much that the fascia can't stretch enough, and then they start to hurt. So you're running and maybe 10 minutes in or 15 minutes in, your calves are starting to swell and they really start to feel tight, like a balloon is going to pop. And then you stop running for the rest of your day, you know, and it goes away. And then it starts coming on earlier and earlier, and it's taking longer and longer to go away after a run. Eventually, it can start happening where when you're just walking fast for, you know, across a parking lot or something, it can happen. But it's always exertion. It's not something that you get at night. It's not you get it watching TV. It's just typically running or maybe walking fast.
Is it going to be at the top of the calf, like where the belly of it is?
Well, it's the big muscle compartment. But it's interesting you say that, because some people may notice that, but they also may notice pain, or more interestingly, numbness and tingling in their feet and toes, because the nerves that go down to the feet and toes go through those calf muscles. And so the swelling of the muscles puts pressure on the nerves. So if you notice tingling in your toes when the calf is swollen, that is going to go along with it. The trick is there aren't that many good ways to get it to go away without surgery, unfortunately. We can try things like physical therapy, but that doesn't do a great job of stretching out those fascial layers. And there's an easy solution, and that's to stop running, but nobody wants to do that.
So if you did stop running, let's say you stopped, okay, I'm going to just stop right now, it's bothering me, and you, let's say, didn't run for a few months, and then you started again, would it come back immediately, or does it kind of reset, or does it kind of sit there?
Most of the time it will come back. It may not come back right away, but as you get back into this shape you were in, very often it comes back.
Okay.
And that's what I get in my practice, is that, you know, people don't want surgery, you know, so they will try physical therapy. They'll try cycling or swimming for a little while. occasionally people will be satisfied by that. But most runners are like, eh, I don't want to give up running. And if they're really limited by it, like I think I have a mild version of this, but not bad. And I just, you know, don't run every day. But I think that if I was as competitive as I was when I was younger, you know, I don't know that. And I'd probably ultimately end up doing the surgery. But you made a great point introducing it, is that I think a lot of people battle this problem and have no idea what it is. And if you go to a doctor that's not familiar with it, you might be diagnosed. They may work you up for a stress fracture or work you up for shin splints, and you may not get a diagnosis. So you look for calf swelling, tightness is a key thing, the numbness and tingling. If that's the case, get it checked out. I mean, surgery is never ideal, but we can get people back to running with that condition.
Okay. So maybe, I know it's not the nicest thing to kind of talk about. You could just kind of squash people's fears a little bit. I mean, again, my husband has told me it wasn't a nice experience, but maybe for people who are maybe considering it, what this actually involves, and maybe it's not as scary as I think it is.
Well, I mean, anytime you do surgery, that's never a good thing. But no, I get what you're saying. I mean, it's an outpatient surgery. You come in one morning, go home the same day. It takes, depending on if you just do, if you've got it on both sides, you might end up doing both legs at the same time. But let's just hypothetically say it's just one leg. Surgery takes about an hour. You go home the same day, may give you crutches for a day or two just for comfort, but you're allowed to put weight on it. There's a little bit of work with a physical therapist, getting your ankle motion back and then starting to get your strength back. But most people, over 4 to 6 weeks, we let you start jogging. Now, you're not really back to the level you were probably for 2 to 3 months. It really depends on how long you had it before you dealt with it. But in my experience, at least, people get back to the same level they were at about 2 or 3 months, except for the people, okay, once a year, probably I'll get somebody that's had it for like 3 years, and then they finally decide to do something. They're a little more challenging, but you can get people back. It's a lot of work with a physical therapist. This is one that I think the rehab is probably worse than the surgery, but I've had pretty good experience with it for people that'll really put in the work. And you're able to do everything else other than running. You can go to work. You can go to school. Yeah. You can. I mean, it's not a problem there. It's just that it's not an instant, like right away, quick fix. It takes some time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you for clearing that up. I just thought we'd talk about that, as I've, compartment syndrome is something I know about, but I don't think many people do know about it. And it does happen sometimes. And it's, like we said, people kind of back into it because they have no idea what this means. But maybe before we kind of wrap up here, you could just tell us about maybe one, two or three common running injuries that you see often, and maybe mistakes people make with each of those. And so we can kind of think about those in the future to prevent them.
Well, I'm going to give one that I think is easily preventable. Now, I think longtime runners probably don't make this mistake as much as people that don't do it as religiously or sort of getting involved in running. You have a big audience of runners and maybe a lot of them that are sort of new to it. We see this a lot. I'm in Charleston, South Carolina, and we have a 10K road race that I want to say is like the sixth or seventh biggest in the country. It's the Cooper River Bridge Run. Mm-hmm. They run over a big bridge. It's like 40,000 people. And I probably see this 20 times right before this race, where people decide maybe 6 weeks before the race, they've never run a day in their life, and they decide they're going to run that race. And that's a lot to ask to get your body ready to run 6.2 miles that quickly. And so they ramp up too quickly and they start to get pain, and they push through that pain because they're determined to run. And now it's a week before or 2 weeks before, and they've got a serious injury. But it isn't just beginners. I see that same phenomenon in people that for the first time, or maybe it's not their first time, try to ramp up and train for a marathon too quickly. Mm-hmm. And the common injury that we see, if they keep pushing through because they're so determined to run that 10K or that marathon or half marathon, whatever it is they end up getting a stress fracture of a bone in their foot or of their leg. And I think, I know this is sort of generic, but I'll give you my rule of thumb about this. It works. I know it's not fun, but the rule of thumb about increasing your training 10% per week prevents stress fractures. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you run 10 miles a week this week and you want to increase, then you go to 11 miles next week and then 12.1 the week after that. So if you're training for a marathon, you decide, all right, the marathon's in December. I need to be able to run, let's just use this, 50 miles a week to get to where I can run 26. So in December, I need to be able to run 50 miles a week, hypothetically. So you do that 10% backwards and figure out, well, then I need to start my training in February. I'm just using hypotheticals, but you work it out so that you give yourself enough time to safely ramp up your training. Right there, you'll cut out a big percentage of the injuries that I see as an orthopedic surgeon mm-hmm. among runners.
No, I would definitely believe that. And, it is difficult, especially like I said, if you are a new runner, and let's say you are running for the first time, and, you say, okay, I'm starting at 10 miles. Am I really going to start like 10 and then 11 and then, building up that slowly? But yeah, if you want to stay healthy and you want to make it to the start line, that really is the best thing to do. Okay, so I just want to ask you before we get on to the Running for Real 4, if someone wants to work with you or if someone is nearby, how can they get in touch with you or what would be the best way for people to reach out to you if they want to online as well?
Yeah, I would honestly, that's probably where I'd point people first. Even if you're in the Southeast or in the Charleston area, I put a lot of time into online communication. And so you may find, things that help you on my website. That's probably where I would start, drdavidgeyer.com. And there's articles about, I love treating injuries for sure. And obviously surgery, but I think if we can prevent injuries, that's what we really need to be doing. So I have a lot of information that hopefully can help you prevent injuries. And then if you need more information than that, I've got videos and podcasts and you can send me questions and things like that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you don't need to see me as a patient, but happy to at any point as well. But fortunately with runners, a vast majority of things we can prevent or take care of early. So you might just check out some of the things on my website first.
I absolutely will put links to all of that in the show notes, which I will put at tinamuir.com/episode15. So I'm just going to take a moment to thank our sponsor and we will be back for the Running for Real 4. I may have stopped running, but one of my favorite sponsors still makes its way into my food every day. Generation Ucan. You probably already know I'm a huge fan of Ucan. No, I used it as my sole fuel source in my 236 marathon. And yes, I was a little bit scared I would bonk, but my energy levels felt exactly the same the entire way. I didn't have those ups and downs, the sugar highs and sugar lows that gels gave me. But maybe you're thinking, yeah, Tina likes Ucan, but what is it? Well, Ucan is a carbohydrate source originally created for a little boy named Jonah, who continually had low blood sugar. Years later, Ucan is a favorite amongst many elites, including everyone's favorite, Meb Keflezighi. Ucan is giving Running for Real listeners 10% off using code RUNNINGFORREAL. So check out generationucan.com for more about Ucan and learn how it can help you control your blood sugar, fuel your races, and maybe make those bottomless pit stomachs of ours be happy for just a little bit longer post-run. All right, David, I want to start the Running for Real 4 with a unique nutrition tip, maybe something that you use or that you enjoy yourself.
Yeah, so I am trying to get stronger and put on some muscle mass, which some runners don't like, but I think mm-hmm. there's some benefits generally to getting some muscle mass. You don't want to necessarily be bulky like a weightlifter, but I think that there are some benefits to muscle strength. So I am trying something. I'm actually sort of a plug for a specific one. I have no vested interest, no financial interest, but I'm right now trying a diet called the Renegade Diet.
Okay.
It's designed for weightlifters, but I've sort of modified it. And it's basically, I'm not a nutritionist, so I'll try to make it as simple as I can. Basically, you don't eat much at all and this is sort of that intermittent fasting for about 14 hours. So from when you had dinner through the night, the next morning, 14 hours where you're not eating. And then for the next 4 hours, so you're eating all your food in an 8-hour window. Mm-hmm. The first 4 hours is basically protein and green vegetables and not heavy calories. And then the second four, essentially the dinner hours, are more carbs with your protein. And I've been really pleased with it. I feel better and I I certainly get more mental work done in the mornings when I don't have the carbs in my body. I've been pleased with it. I actually lost a little bit of belly fat and I feel like I perform better. Check with your doctor. I know I'm a doctor, but I am not giving you advice, but I've been really pleased with it. And I actually think it would work for runners and not just people trying to get bulky.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing. And again, like you said, make sure you check with your doctor if you do decide you want to try that. But again, as with diets, it's always what works for you. You know, it isn't necessarily going to work for someone else. So consider that and see what you think. All right. What about a running for real moment? Maybe a moment that, you know, only runners would understand. And you maybe have a funny one coming from your kind of background of working with runners.
Well, I did break my ankle when I was running, trying to get around some sorority girls in college, which was really embarrassing. No, mine is not funny, but it's one that I'll never forget, and I'll try to keep it short. But I almost died running, actually. I was in college. I loved running as sort of my break between going to class and studying at night. And it was probably 90-something degrees. I'm running in shorts, no shirt. And finish running, go into my dorm room to start doing some sit-ups and ab stuff. And I start having trouble breathing. Think I'm hyperventilating. I'm a college kid. I don't know anything. So I try like the brown paper bag. And then I'm like getting like where my vision is getting foggy and my ears are popping. And now I'm talking where it's like my airway was closing up. I couldn't make sounds normally. And I was panicking. So ran to student health at Wake Forest where I went to college and they were already closed. I'm pounding on the door. Fortunately, the nurse and the doctor were still there. They pull me in and very quickly realized that I was having anaphylactic shock, basically a severe allergic reaction, gave me some Benadryl, gave me some epinephrine and sent me to the emergency room. Scary as can be, because that's the only time in life I've ever felt like I was going to die. The frustrating part of it, and part of the reason I tell the story is part of the reason why I went into sports medicine is they never figured out what happened. They did all these allergy tests, never found anything that I was allergic to that could have set that off. They just called it exercise-induced anaphylaxis. They made me carry an EpiPen for a while, which I eventually just stopped doing. But really, really scary phenomenon. Yeah. And it's one that you don't forget that type of thing, unfortunately.
Sure.
Not to bring down your listeners.
No. This is for. And did it take you a while to kind of want to go run again? Were you like afraid of running for a while or not?
I was afraid of that happening again. I loved the running. And I was the stupid college kid that was just convinced that they were wrong, that something that I had eaten something or I gotten stung by a bee or something. I just didn't believe it was exercise induced. So I wasn't as worried about running as I was terrified that it would happen again. But I love exercise enough that I wasn't about to stop running.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And kind of a scary situation, but you were okay, thankfully. And yeah. You're talking to us now today. So then what about a high moment as a runner?
Yeah, I will still tell you that I, this sounds so corny, but I was trying when I was thinking about this, trying to remember how old I was, but I want to say I was 13 or 14. And it was the first race I ever ran. And I had never run like for distance. My parents were big runners at the time. They take a 13-year-old kid to this 5K who would probably never, I had run for soccer, you know, for sports, but I had never like run just, you know, road running. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I've run tons of races over my life since then, but there was something about being a 13-year-old kid just doing something they had never done before with hundreds of other people. I don't know. Oh, there was something about that I don't know how I could ever recreate. Mm-hmm. I imagine it would be, you know, that's why people are constantly trying new things. There was something about the novelty that I haven't recreated.
Absolutely. I could definitely see that being the case. And so I don't know if you do still race or if that was something, you know, that you haven't been doing recently, but if you were going to race, what would you tell yourself when you're kind of on the start line or in the starting area getting ready to go?
I don't know that there's something I say as much as I kind of feel like this it probably doesn't make any sense. I do a lot of public speaking, either for medical talks or, you know, I did a TEDx talk not too long ago. And there's something in that 2 minutes before you step on stage, a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of excitement, a little bit of, I don't know how this is going to go, that I feel the same way right before a race for some reason. It's, you know, the heart's racing a little faster. You're around a bunch of people you don't really know half the time. This could go really well, or I could trip at the starting line. And so I don't know that I say anything, or I love that sort of uncertainty and excitement in a sort of a weird way. I know that that's probably not a normal thing. Like I think that is pretty normal about many things, but that's one that, and then 5 steps after I start, it's all fine.
I think that's very, very typical. I think most people would probably agree with you for that one. So you don't have to do this, but I do ask my guests to send us a photo of them standing in what I call a power pose. So this will be where you stand, maybe your hands on your hips. You can get someone to take a photo of you, or maybe you have something, maybe it's even one that you have already on your website that you would, you know, put yourself in a pose before you go on stage to talk or something, where you're building your confidence, you're helping yourself feel good. And, you know, they've been proven to be very effective. Will you send us some kind of power pose to put on the show notes?
Yeah, I'll do that. I don't think I have any on my website, but I can absolutely.
Great.
Because I've got a couple in mind. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. And then just one more thing before we sign off here. You did just mention about your TEDx, and I'm sure that would have perked up some ears of people. So maybe tell us about what that was like to kind of speak on that kind of level.
Terrifying, quite honestly. You know, it was one of those, I gave a talk on youth sports and some of what we talked about earlier, some of the issues in youth sports, pushing kids too hard and some of the crazy things that are happening with recruiting kids at really young ages and kids going to online schools and things like that. But I had the opportunity, I applied, I have a speaking coach, he really pushed me to do it and had the opportunity, I got selected. And if anybody's ever given a TED or TEDx talk, I don't know how everybody else is, but I rehearsed it hundreds of times, probably 2 or 3 hours a day, you know, pacing in my office here. And it was a great experience, but it was one of the harder things I've done professionally in my career.
Yeah. Well, well done for doing it. And I will put links in the show notes so people can check that out if they are interested, along with your website and any other information that we have. So, David, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for telling us all this really helpful information. It's been fantastic to learn from you, and I'm sure people are going to want to go find out more.
Yeah, this was so much fun. I really appreciate you having me. I hope any runners out there take home the message that we're trying to keep you healthy and not shut you down from running. So stay active and keep enjoying it, because I think it's a great type of exercise. I'm thrilled that you're getting the message out to so many people to get them excited about running.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. You guys have heard it from him. This is another one you can trust. So make sure you go check out the website. All right. Was that an action-packed episode? I really enjoyed that one, and especially the conversation about children in sports. That's something I am really passionate about, because you see it so often that kids are burned out too early and they end up losing all interest in the sport and just hating it, which just makes me really sad. So I hope that was interesting for you too, even though it was something that I'm just curious about and thought maybe you guys would be interested as well. So you can find everything we talked about today, including links to David's website and just anything else and his TED talk as well, at tinamuir.com/episode15. So next week, we are going to be learning all about parkrun. If you don't know what that is, you are going to love it, because it features, well, I guess people that tend to participate are wonderful people like you. And hopefully, if it's not already somewhere where you are, it will be coming to your town, your city, your location pretty soon. It is really interesting to learn from the founder, Paul Sinton Hewitt, and I know you're going to love that one. So I want to thank you in advance for taking the time to review or subscribe or whatever in the podcast. Anything you do to share it with your friends, share it with your group, just support me. That really, really means a lot. And I want to thank you for all the support you've given me over this past few years. So I hope you have a wonderful week. I am home in England right now. My best friend is getting married next week, so I'm very excited for that. And lots of wedding festivities this week. I hope you are enjoying yourself, not melting too much in the heat, and I will see you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.